It's time for dessert.
You are listening to The Bill Podcast with me, Natalie Rolls. Brought to you in association with georgefairbrother.com, shop.saturdaymorningpress.co.uk, cityfiction.co.uk, and vanguardcomics.co.uk. Welcome to the finale of my three-course feast of an interview with the wonderful Pal Aaron. I don't know about you, but dessert is my favourite dish. So this third and final part is an extended interview for you Bill fans to enjoy. Pal and I continue to discuss his time at Sun Hill, where I ask him to share some memories of some of our lovely colleagues. Pal also reflects on his time on the Cobbles, his role in the BAFTA-winning sitcom Stella, his recent writing work, a dream job on the big screen, and we both share stories about the music icon Prince. But first things first, let's go back in time to our Sun Hill days from 20 years ago. You did loads of work with the wonderful Connie Hyde. How do you find working with Connie? Because I just saw lots of in-depth conversation in the corridors, you two. You were always working away.
Yes.
Conjuring these amazing performances.
Connie was great to work with. And, you know, that's so funny you say that, Matt, that we were always, you always saw us chatting away and working. And, you know, I haven't changed. I do that all the time on every job. I did it before the bill. I do it after the bill. I'm always of the mind that the script is not the end point. The script is the start point. Mm-hmm. And with every take you have is a chance to get it better. When I say get it better, that's a very vague term. What the hell does that mean? What I mean is it's a chance to be more truthful, more honest, much more on point with the story. Do you know what I mean? And so every moment you get, if you're working with an actor who's like-minded, and Connie was like-minded, and loads of actors I work with are like-minded, in between takes, they will try and work at it more, have a little discussion. Sometimes not. Sometimes it's better just to leave it. It depends on the scene, the mood of the scene. But with something like The Bill, we were always nattering away. We've got this scene coming up. We've got this, talking through it. It was usually running lines. You know what it's like, Nat. You get actors all the time running lines with each other.
I mean, it was such a fast turnover, and those points that you want to really make that little scene. It might be a very, you know, like you say, a corridor scene.
Yeah.
You just want to make sure that you're on the same thread.
Exactly.
And that you can find those highlights and make it cheeky, make it, you know, just find those bits. It's like an artist. It's painting that picture.
Yes. And I remember, Nat, you must have had this more than me, actually. But I remember my flat in Wimbledon that I used to have when we were doing The Bill. The wall of my living room was covered with pages and story arcs.
Yes.
So you're shooting 3-4 episodes at a time. I think you did more. Actually, I think there was a handful of you that were doing about 5 or 6 episodes at a time, something crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all shot out of order, of course. And you're trying to make this arc make sense. On day one, you're shooting the end of the story. On day 12, you're shooting the beginning. And you've got to work out where I am and which emotional state I'm in today.
Yes.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how torn and knackered and beside himself is Brandon today when his kids have been kidnapped? You know, and often you see actors having a little discussion all the time before they go in and shoot or whatever. And I love that part of it. I love it. But it is down to you, and you do have to focus, and you do have to say, oh, no, hold on, he's at this level, because that hasn't quite happened yet, has it? this moment hasn't happened. We're playing the scene before then. And so you're discussing things to try and get into the right mood and to get at the right point of the story before you go in and shoot. Because there is very, you know, we didn't really have much rehearsal, did we, Matt?
Oh, no, it was on the go. You just had to, you say, you make your rehearsals in between the cups of tea and...
Absolutely.
And those change arounds. You're right, those familiar pieces of paper, the colours of the scripts on the floor.
Yes.
I love that. It was the jigsaw.
Yes.
That's part of it. It looked like a forensic room.
Crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, you had your sticky notes on top. And exactly as you said it, you know, that 1 to 10... How am I feeling now? Where am I in the story? And I mean, you in those, that crazy lady who had you in the boiler room. I mean, it was just, wow. Watching it back for me, I was there. I was in your performances. It was stunning work.
Thank you. And you know what? That's Robbie Del Maestro, the director who directed my leaving storyline. And he was determined to get the camera right in. Right into your face, right into the wound, the knife wound, and right, you know, so it was a lot of it was, there was nothing on sticks. Everything was handheld in that boiler room. And the crew were knackered, the camera crew were knackered, they were carrying this thing on their shoulder and moving with it, running with it. Some Steadicam stuff. It's funny, isn't it? When we were shooting that, you know, you've got to get into a kind of atmosphere, a kind of mood. And I remember I had my, what would it have been then? Would it have been a CD player? I don't think it was a phone with music on it back then. But I used to listen to a track by Peter Gabriel from his soundtrack to The Last Temptation of Christ.
Oh.
I forget the title of the track. But I remember if I listened to the first minute of that, it would put me in a mood that I thought was right for that situation.
Perfect. Music does that.
Yeah, music does do that. Music does that immediately, doesn't it? It takes you to a place that is just... The other day I was watching the Wham documentary on Netflix.
Yes, it was fantastic.
It's brilliant, isn't it? Isn't it great? Yeah. But now every song that's played on that documentary takes you immediately to a certain moment in your life.
Oh, did you have any of those T-shirts? I had one of those T-shirts with...
Was it Choose Life?
I think it was Choose Life, and it was a duck egg blue sort of long T-shirt dress.
You see, that sounds cool.
And I can instantly remember, like you just said, it's like you go straight back. So yeah. The piece of music just puts you in the flavour of what you're trying to achieve. It's so clever.
Exactly. And that's why we listen to certain, I guess we listen to certain type of music in the morning. It's a nice way to wake up.
Mm-hmm.
And the evening, sometimes you like to chill out, you might have other music on, and it's no different when you're working. There is certain music that puts you in a certain mood that for you is right to start work, you know.
I wonder what Connie's were, wonder what her tracks were, if she was playing any music.
I don't know if Connie was playing music. Everybody has their own way, don't they?
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what's interesting. You just reminded me. Connie and I hardly spoke in between takes in that boiler room. We just kept our distance. We were in our own world. She had an agenda. I had an agenda as Brandon and Kathy, not as actors, but we were both very open as actors. And I really liked working with Connie. But we knew that, hold on, this is a bit intense here. So the situation is intense and we need to serve it. We need to serve it up properly. Otherwise, you can't look like mates in a scene like that. You can't look like mates who are pretending. You've got to be... You've both got things at stake and you've got to play those stakes for the value that they are, you know.
It was interesting. Someone tweeted me about there's some reruns at the moment. They said, how, you know, for your character, she's now with Ray Baker doing the lesbian scenes. Was that something that you felt comfortable with?
Yes.
I just said, you know, that was written and that's our job.
Exactly.
To make it realistic. So simple as that. I'm going to say some other names and let's see if you have any memories. Simon Rouse.
Simon Rouse is lovely and so funny. So funny. Simon used to love talking about, and I loved it too, and I think we used to love talking about theatre. And Simon Rouse started out in theatre in really kind of cool guerrilla theatre up north when he first became an actor.
Yes.
Political theatre as well, I think. And we used to love talking about theatre all the time. And then we'd catch ourselves, and for some reason we'd piss ourselves laughing because we realised we were having a little moment of being lovies, you know, talking about art and literature and words that really matter for an actor. But we would bring ourselves back down to earth.
I love Simon.
Simon's lovely, yeah. And he's I think he was a wicked actor, incredibly charismatic, really charismatic.
Yeah.
He used to wear his Ted Baker suits and his cropped hair. And he looked like an ex-boxer, looked like a prize fighter. He was very cool. He looked like someone you don't mess with, head of CID. And I thought, yeah, man, that guy's cool. And then you get to chat to him, you realise he's an actor and he likes to have a laugh. Him and Harold Simons came to see me at the RSC, actually. I was doing a couple of plays. One of the plays I did was Macbeth, and we did it in 90 minutes without an interval, which is exactly why they came to see it. They said, what are you doing? I said, I'm doing King Lear. How long's that? I said, it's about 3.5 hours. Oh, God, what's the other one? I said, Macbeth, 90 minutes without an interval. All right, we'll book tickets for that.
Brilliant.
They wanted to get into the pub as soon as possible. Waited till I got there, and then we all went back to my cottage where we were joined by other cast members and we had a bit of an all-nighter.
Russell Floyd.
Oh, Russell was lovely. Russell's lovely. I was on a night out with Russell, and I don't know why, and I can't remember which city. I want to say Birmingham. And Russell and I went out for a few drinks. Maybe he came to see a show I was doing. I can't remember. But nah, it was like going out with a rock star. I swear to you, every pub, every bar we went into, there was a crowd surrounding him wanting to chat. And I thought, and that's from his EastEnders time, I guess. I mean, I would not know how to deal with that. I'd be like, you know, deeply embarrassed and trying to get away. But he dealt with it like a superstar. And I was like, wow, how'd you do that, man? And he's like, oh, they just want to say hello. And I like having a chat. And I thought he looked so easy with it. And I would look deeply uncomfortable with it, I'm sure. I'm sure I would. Yeah, lovely. Really lovely. I mean, come on. We had a good time on the bill because we worked with good people. And that's what I mean, you know, these shows I've done that I've left, I only have good memories of them. So I left when the time was right for me, you know. Go on, give us another name.
Roberta.
Roberta Taylor is so incredibly smart and wise and so experienced and doesn't even talk about it, won't have these stories to tell you. She will just be a pro. And she's one of those actors who make you raise your game when you're working with her. You work with and you think, oh, you're quite classy, aren't you? And it makes you raise your game so you don't look really crap next to her. And I think she's one of those actors who makes people around her raise their game and say, come on, let's do better. We can be at this level.
Class.
What was her husband's name?
Peter?
Guinness.
That's it.
Like, what a charismatic actor he is.
What a couple. When they used to rock up together.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, such a cool dresser, snappy dresser.
Yeah, very smart, very cool couple. We all had an evening together in a couple of bars. I think we ended up in Groucho's. And I think it was Roberta's birthday. Really cool couple. Very lovely, lovely couple.
Another cool person coming up, Trudy Goodwin.
Trudy's so classy. So classy. And you know what? She's another one. If I watch reruns, your performance is timeless. You could do that today. It still works. It hasn't aged. Trudy's another one. And that's something to do with the economy of performance, I think. She looks timeless. Her work, her performance looks timeless. It hasn't got an old feel about it. It hasn't got an aged style of acting. It is just honest and minimal and still works. She's very smart.
Mark Wingett.
Mark Wingett is really cool. Now, when I first started, I had a lot of my stuff with Mark, and that's just the way the scheduling was. And he was really lovely, I thought. And I was very aware that Mark had this massive background with a lot of cool films. And he's got a lot of stories to tell. And what I used to love was you'd get these guest actors who would come in, and people like Mark and Trudy would know them really well. And I remember one actor called Gary Cooper. That's a name you won't forget. I remember him rocking up to do a storyline. And we were on location and me, Mark and Gary were in a trailer together. And I just loved listening to their stories. They were pissing themselves at these adventures they had. And they would tell me, they'd say, oh, this happened. Oh, pal, this happened. And Mark did this. And I thought, oh, man, they've had a wicked life, man.
And always having a great time, Mark. Yeah. He's always off doing something.
Exactly. these actors getting up to all kinds of stuff in the 60s and 70s, all these adventures, away shooting, the kind of material, the directors they were working with, really off the hip, you know. And I thought, that is a different way of working, man. I loved it. I loved hearing about it.
There was obviously the showbiz side of the bill, the press nights, the soap awards. What has been your experience of all that side of the game?
I always avoided it, Matt. I never went to them.
Really?
On Casualty, I never went to them. On The Bill, I never went to them. On Coronation Street, I never went to them. I only started going to a couple when I was doing Stella. But before then, I didn't go to any of them. I avoided them.
So you're quite glad that we didn't have Twitter back in 2003?
All that stuff's passed me by, really, Nat.
Mm.
I see and read now and again that there are photos online of people letting their hair down and having a party and all this. And I kind of think, well, why shouldn't they? They work hard. They should be allowed to play as they want to play.
Do you think it's helpful for someone's career?
I think it must be, because so many actors tell me that it is. I have no experience of it personally. I can only believe them and say, oh, is it? All right. Well, they do all this social media and they say, well, I got meetings through Twitter, really. Yeah. I worked with an actress recently who said, oh, my God, my last three jobs all came from Twitter.
Oh, it's extraordinary, isn't it? That's never happened to me.
It's never happened to me. This is a world I know nothing about, very, very little about. So I guess it's true.
Mm.
But honestly, the only reason I avoided those evenings, to me, it felt like dressing up to go to work. And I just prefer the work. You know, I would rock up in shorts and a T-shirt and sandals, whatever I was wearing, and get into my costume and go to work. The idea of dressing up to go out for an evening of awards is kind of work. It's a work evening. And I just didn't want to dress up to go to work.
Yeah, you've just done a full day at the office. And
exactly. Do you remember when we all sang at the Royal Albert Hall? That was fantastic.
That was amazing. Christmas
time. Yeah, and there's no way I was going to miss that. That's a chance to sing at the Royal Albert Hall. And listen to me, sing like it's a solo or it's a proper singer. It's the cast of The Bill singing We Wish You a Merry Christmas or something like that. And I thought, yo, I ain't going to miss stepping on that stage. So I went to that because I knew that everyone would be kind of chilled out and having a silly old laugh. So that's good. When I was doing Stella with Ruth Jones, Ruth was really lovely. And she'd always make a point of about halfway through the shoot, she'd say, right, we're all going to go out and have some dinner. Please come. You can make it. Bring your partners, whatever. It's all just, we're just going to hang out and have some food. And it was a really lovely thing to do. It was a nice way to mark the high point, and then you carry on, you know, just to keep spirits up. Not that they were flagging. They very, very rarely do want a comedy. When you work on a comedy show, everyone's always usually quite buoyant. But I do remember going to a couple of those evenings, and it was just so lovely to see the female boom and the female grip and mm-hmm. the costume girls, the makeup girls, and they're all dressed up a bit. And it's like, wow, you look great. You don't normally see them like that because they're at work, you know? They just want to tie their hair back and get on with the job. And then they have an evening where they do their hair and they put on a frock. And it's like, yay, man, this looks really cool. And, of course, I'm dressed in my T-shirt and my shorts and my sandals. Of course.
Oh, it's so nice. No, they're good moments when you're out of work and relaxed in the pub. I remember the Scottish brothers that were the first assistant directors.
Oh!
There was that pub, the Purcell brothers, and there used to be that little pub they used to frequent.
That's right. And there was a painting on the wall of one of them.
That's it.
Yes. It was either their dad or their uncle. But the painting on the wall was their family member.
Yes. I think it was the dad.
And Glyn always used to say, Glyn was the one I saw more often, with the suede leather jacket.
Yes.
And the slightly messy beard.
Yes.
And he always used to say, used to make me laugh. I mean, it's totally just silly, but there was a producer on the flight deck called Cliff, tall guy with a dark beard and always wore a cowboy hat.
Yes.
Glyn used to say, okay, once we've talked about the scene and furniture needs to be cleared, he used to say, okay, let's get in here, get rid of those chairs, tables, settee, filing cabinet, shove them all in Cliff's office. Anything you were moving, right? Everybody, we need to get this rug up. We need to put down a trap, lift the rug, take it into Cliff's office. everything, anything and everything to say Cliff's office.
It was busting at the seams, Cliff's office.
Well, I don't know what he had against poor Cliff, but maybe not. Oh, maybe not best of mates.
This is great memory lane. You're really remembering all lovely bits here.
It's funny, isn't it? I do remember. I mean, God, when did we leave? A long time ago. But I do remember it pretty well.
20 years ago. Where is the strangest place you've ever been recognised?
Venice. Venice on a boat on the Grand Canal. When you can't escape. You can't exactly say, okay, and jump overboard and swim, you know, like the clappers.
How did you deal with that? What happened?
Well, people are just really lovely normally. They just want to say hi, they've seen you on the telly and they want to talk about it. I was on a boat on the Grand Canal, and I think I'm pretty sure that I've been twice, once on my own and once with my missus, and I'm pretty sure it was on the occasion when I was with my missus. And this young woman said, I mean, she must have been, what, late 20s, early 30s, and she said, hi, sorry to bother you. You're Brandon on the bell. I said, yeah, hello, I am. Yeah, how you doing? All right. And she said, oh, I watch it all the time. And we just had a little chat about the programme. While, you know, these beautiful buildings.
Okay. We're talking about the bell.
You just looked past the Palazzo Ducale there and you said, you're Brandon off the bill. And I thought, okay, can we go back a bit? Can you just reverse the boat? Do you want to take that in first and see how beautiful that is? We'll talk about the bill any old time. I did find that quite funny. But she's very sweet, you know, and happily that conversation didn't last the whole journey. So we were both able to just, you know, enjoy the beauty around us as well.
Do you get a different sort of recognition from Bill fans compared to, say, Stella or...
Yes. Yeah. Nat, you know that look. When somebody looks at you, there's a look they give you before they even speak and you know they think they know you. They've recognised you, right? So before I started Stella, if it was a woman who came up to me, I knew that it was from Casualty. If it was a scary-looking bloke, I knew it was from The Bill. But ever since I've done Stella, it's anybody. Men, women, old, young, everywhere, anywhere, you know. And they were always lovely. They were always really nice, but it was always scary-looking blokes who'd come up to me and talk about The Bill. Yo, you're off The Bill, innit? Yo, you play that detective, innit? But yeah, man, yeah, I do.
Was it your decision to leave?
Yes, because it became very clear to me that they didn't have many ideas for my character.
Yeah.
Do you know what happened was, I remember a friend of mine, a director or a writer from before, who was on the show and was in a meeting talking about storylines. And we were going to have a beer in the evening anyway. So we met up and had a beer. And he said, I had the most bizarre conversation today, you know. I said, really? He said, about you? I said, oh my God, here we go. A bizarre conversation about me. All right. He said, no, not in that way. He said, we're talking about storylines. And one of the producers said, so, look, we need to get some Indian storylines for Brandon to get involved in. And he said, why do they need to be Indian storylines in particular? He said, he's a policeman. Why don't you just give him crimes? That's what policemen do, solve crimes in TV drama, you know. And I thought, yeah. And it wasn't, that conversation wasn't the beginning of it. The beginning of my decision to want to leave, it happened maybe 6 months before then. But that kind of made me think that's exactly the suspicion I had and why I want to leave. So I would not have got a great storyline and something to do for a few months had I not wanted to leave. Of that, I'm convinced. Convinced enough to want to leave the show. So after The Bill, I went to the RSC and then I did a really lovely TV series that only ran for one season called The Cup for BBC. It was about football teams for under 11s, but it was about how the kids just get on with each other and want to play the game and have a love the game, and how the parents squabble, fight, and basically behave appallingly. And it was a really lovely comedy and we had a great time on it, but it only went for one series, so that was a shame.
In 2006, you joined Coronation Street. What was that like?
Not great. I didn't really enjoy that. It's one of the few jobs I've had where I was really not happy about doing it. There were some lovely things about it. Kim Marsh was really, really lovely and lovely to work with. There were a few actors, actually, there who were lovely to work with. Half the cast were great and half the cast had this strange mentality. For me, it was a strange mentality. Having come from drama and going into a show like that, that is legendary and that is massive, and these well-established characters who, they had a different way of working than I was used to. And I could see that half the cast were used to working in the way that I work. I had that in common with them, but there were half the cast that worked in a completely different way. I heard an actor say, "I can't say that line. My public would never accept it."
Ooh, my public.
And I thought, wow, okay. There were a lot of agendas being played, and I thought the only agenda we should be playing was the story. Let's play the story. But there were other agendas at work, and I just thought, ooh, this is not my environment. So I was happy to leave.
Well, a few years later, you landed a stellar job in Ruth Jones's BAFTA-winning sitcom, Stella.
The Stella gig was brilliant, yeah. Went on for, what, 6 years? My God, we didn't think it would do that. We did 6 series and about 3 Christmas specials on top of that. And it was fantastic. I loved it. Loved it. Really lovely people, lovely crew, lovely cast. Funny and doing more comedy stuff. And I love doing comedy stuff.
You were brilliant in that.
Well, thank you. Thanks.
It was totally different.
Yes, it was totally different. And also, I haven't seen an Indian character do the things that I did on Stella. I've not seen an Indian character be in charge of a Welsh male voice choir and sing songs exclusively by Queen. You know, and things like that were like, oh, yeah, let's do it. You know, we were singing We Will Rock You at a regional rugby club as halftime entertainment. And Jag was leading the choir. It was like, let's do this. I love it. I love this writing. Just crazy ideas. And we just went with it. And it was like, yeah, all right. And you could tell that's an actor who's written that. Ruth wrote most of them. And then we had some fantastic writers on it anyway. And also, you know what, Nat? We had a lot of famous people on it who were real fans of the show. Jonathan Ross was in an episode. Robert Plant came in to do... He was at Daddy's funeral. There was a character called Daddy in it. And when Daddy died, we had a wake for him in a local church. And Robert Plant was the entertainment. And Robert Plant was a massive fan of the show.
Yeah.
One of my old friends from school, Tim, used to play Hammond organ in one of Robert Plant's bands. And when they played at a small club in Dudley, just outside of Birmingham, I went to see them, you know, because it was my mate who was playing organ. And he said, come on, come backstage and, you know, meet everyone. I was like, oh, yeah. And it was quite funny. And the drummer said, hey, you're from The Bill. And he wanted a photo. So my missus is a big fan of The Bill. I'm going to have a photo with you. Is that all right? Yeah, of course. This guy's a wicked drummer I've just seen performing. And he wants to do that. But Robert Plant, when he came on Stella, we were talking about my mate Tim, and that was really quite sweet, you know.
Oh.
So Stella was a bit of a dream job.
And, I mean, pal, you were in The Archers.
The Archers!
Didn't you win an award?
Yeah, I won an LOTCR award for my work on The Archers. LOTCR is an acronym for Learning Outside the Classroom. And I don't know a great deal about this organisation, but they look for programmes, television programmes, film programmes, radio programmes that are entertaining as well as educational. And, I mean, gosh, when do we ever stop appreciating those things? I guess why... That's why Attenborough's Blue Planet is so successful and National Geographic are so big around the world for the same reasons. But the other nominees were Dara O'Brien for his science programme, I think, and Justin Fletcher, who plays Mr. Tumble, for his preschool learning. And I won, which was a massive shock to me and a delight, actually, because Dara O'Brien has those skills. Justin Fletcher has those skills in Makaton and preschool teaching, whereas... What they liked about my episode was the writing, really. And so when the award ceremony happened, which I couldn't go to because I was filming Stella, they asked me to write a little speech to be read out there. And I wrote that it was all down to the writers on The Archers. That's what appealed to them as a story. That's what they liked about the learning outside the classroom aspect. I played a character called Ifty, who was, he had an on-off, will-they-won't-they relationship with Elizabeth. I was also a part-time maths tutor, and I would teach, she hired me to teach her son, Freddie, as a private tutor for maths. And the way I guess I taught him was to take him outside of the home, and we're outside the classroom anyway because it's private tuition, and I would take him around the house, the big hall, and I would tell him about pointing out certain architectural features. I would teach him about angles and you know, perpendicular angles and obtuse acute angles that are located in the architecture of the building. It was lovely writing, it was clever writing, and so I did the right thing, and I paid my dues to the writers and mentioned them in the speech and said it was all about the writing.
The writers, yep, we are merely vessels of their words.
Yeah.
Do you like working in audio?
I do like working on audio. Yes, I do. I do like doing radio plays. I like doing radio dramas.
It's something new that I've only just got into with Letter from Helvetica.
Yes, that's getting a lot of traction.
I enjoy that process. It's totally different. You're developing a character in audio. It's nice. I like it.
Yes, it is. And also, because there are no visuals, the writing is at the forefront. The words are at the forefront. How they're written and how they're spoken is paramount. And that's a nice way for an actor to work sometimes, especially when you're like you and I, kind of predominantly known as TV actors, I suppose. To work in a medium that is not about visuals, it's an interesting little diversion, and I like it.
And you're currently writing and producing a radio play, Shakespeare's Women.
Shakespeare's Women is an idea I had after reading a biography on Shakespeare, and the idea that there were three really important women in his life. The first one was his first love, the woman he wanted to marry. The second one was the woman he did marry, possibly because he made her pregnant. And the third one is a lady who's referred to as the Dark Lady in some of his sonnets. And she was kind of his sexual awakening as an adult. And they began a kind of a dangerous, very passionate love affair. And I thought it would be really interesting to see Shakespeare's life and times through their eyes. All three characters speak modern English, which is the bits that I've written, and they're written in a kind of poem. And then all three characters also speak Shakespeare's language, and some of them are his most famous speeches. Some of them are perhaps more obscure. But each of the speeches I've chosen do suit each one of those three characters, and they comment on events in his life, moments of success, love, loss. And as a piece, even though it's a work of fiction, it does question, well, look, if people are this close to you and this important in your life, you don't forget them, you are influenced by them. And I kind of suggest that, well, maybe some of the female characters that he wrote are maybe based on these three women, and his relationship with them.
How brilliant.
I think it could be a really good little companion piece in schools and colleges before they go on and read their first Shakespeare or listen to their first Shakespeare. And perhaps just a little look at or a listen to his Shakespeare's life and times and the things he went through in stages of his life as the young boy about town, the young buck, the young lover, the husband, the father. It might just assist in the appreciation of his plays and his characters, and especially the female characters, which is the angle that I have taken with Shakespeare's women.
This is fascinating, pal. This sounds really good.
I'm hoping we can do something with that, yeah.
So, in between jobs, I mean, this is sort of something that you'll dabble with, you'll write things, you'll keep active and thinking and feeling and.
There's a couple of things I've written. I really like children's fiction.
Ooh.
I've written two children's books. One is completed and the other one I'm halfway through. The first one that I've completed is called Maharaja's Party. It's set in India 500 years ago. It's all seen through a modern lens. It's very modern humour and, of course, it's modern language. And it's a morality tale. Maharaja means great king, and this character is anything but a great king. He's rude, he's obnoxious, he's immature, and he has to learn to be nice to people. He has to learn humility. With great power comes great responsibility. He decides to have a party where he's his usual boisterous self, and through the help of other Maharajas around the other kingdoms who all turn up for his party, throughout the course of the party and the events that happen, he learns to eat a bit of humble pie and learns what it is to be a good leader, a good ruler, not only from the other Maharajas, but mainly from Ramu, his gardener. And the other story that I'm halfway through is called Appu's Mechanical Grandma. And that is it's a modern setting. It's set in modern day Midlands. Appu is a 9-year-old boy in a single parent family. He lives with his mum, Sita, who is an inventor. And Sita is having difficulties striking a work-life balance, and it's cutting her up that she can't spend as much time with Apu as she'd like. So, as a temporary measure, she invents a robot who is going to spend time with him, help him with homework and things like that, just until she finishes her latest invention for the expo, which she hopes will sell and take them, get them out of the financial hardship. And this very strong bond begins to forge between Apu and the robot. And the robot is not designed to live forever. The villain of the piece is a guy called Simeon Silas, who has a very dark secret about how he's able to win the expo. He's won the last five expos. So ultimately, there is going to be a showdown between Simeon Silas, Sita, possibly the robot, and we just hope that Apu is not part of the collateral damage. So,
absolutely brilliant. So do you think keep pushing through and, you know, just keep going with the flow? Do you think that brings results?
The first one, Maharaja's Party, has actually gone out to quite a few publishers already, and they've been really lovely about it, saying he's a very endearing character and the book is charming. It just wasn't what they were looking for at that time. So I just bring it back, and if I think it needs rejigging, I rejig it and send it out again. So my agent is looking after my manuscripts and my audio play, Shakespeare's Women, and looking after the copyright until such time as we, you know, find a producer, hopefully, who wants to take the books and the audio play further. And yeah, we'll just take it from there.
Fabulous. Imagine, right, so we're on a stranded island, desert island.
Yeah.
And if there was one author, the complete works of one author that you could take with you.
Yes.
Who would it be?
It would be Shakespeare, because I've not read all his plays, and they're so rich and complex that by the time you've got halfway through that and really understood what the plays are about, you'll probably be saved. And so you can think, oh, well, I'll read the rest of it in the comfort of my own home. And it is entertaining, and it is pure entertainment value as well as keeping your brain cells working. But also there is a writer, he's an Indian writer called R.K. Narayan. He wrote a series of books set in a fictional village in India called Malgadi. And it's about a little boy called Swami, who is 9 years old, and you follow him through his daily life, through his village of Malgadi in rural India. And you see the guy on his bike whose job is to sharpen knives and scissors, and you see the tailor, and you see the courtesans above the tailor's room. You see the guy who owns the local coffee shop, and he wonders how he ever makes money because he always seems to be giving free coffee to his friends. And he just gets involved in all these coming-of-age dramas. And that, I used to love that before I went to India. And on my return from India, I went straight to a bookshop and bought more. And I thought, this is the flavour of India. My God, that's why when I went to India, it felt familiar because of these books. I would sneak into my bag some R.K. Narayan, but I would say, yes, I'll take the Shakespeare. And I would read the Shakespeare, but I would also read the Narayan. Absolutely.
Well, that's going to be on my list. Thank you for that.
I can recommend them. They're really charming. So charming, those books.
Oh, because another big part of your life is music.
Yeah.
If you had complete works of one musician or a band to keep you company on your desert island, who would you take?
It would be Prince and Mozart. Am I only allowed to choose one?
Yeah.
Oh, God. I think it would be Prince. It would be Prince. Yeah, yeah.
I'm there with Prince. Did you ever see him live?
Oh, gosh, four or five times?
Oh, you beat me then.
Hey, do you know what I did, Matt? Once, when we were on the bill, Prince was playing at the Hammersmith Apollo. I didn't have a ticket, but we wrapped early on our unit. And I said to Chris, I think Chris Simmons, I said, Chris, I'm going to go to Hammersmith Apollo, man. I'm going to get a ticket from a town and I'm going to see if I can watch Prince tonight. He said, are you really? I said, do you want to come? He said, I can't tonight. I've got stuff on, you know. I said, I'm going to try it. It's nothing to lose, is it? And I got there and there was a tout who sold me the ticket at face value because it was only valid for that night. I got there about half an hour before the show was due to start. And he said, hey, mate, listen, do you want this? And I said, how much? He said, well, that, you know, because I ain't going to sell it now. It's about to start. It's for tonight. And I got it at face value. And I went in and I saw him on his tour of the Rainbow Children.
Oh.
It was brilliant.
And such a great venue.
I'll tell you another cool Prince story. I took a friend of mine, an actor friend of mine. He'd never seen Prince. And I took him to the O2. He was doing a tour for the 3121 album. And every ticket was £31.21. Now, there's a man who wants to sell music. He could have sold his tickets for God knows how much, but he sold them all for 31.21. So I took my mate Adam to go and see it. And the concert finished and everybody was leaving. And I said to him, I said, just hang around a minute, because he sometimes comes back on. We waited 10 minutes, 15 minutes. People are still chatting, leaving. A lot of them have left. He walks on while the house lights are still up and while the techies are breaking the stage down. He walked on and I said, there you go. We ran right down to the front. So we were two rows from the front now. Some people started coming back in when people were shouting, oh, come back. Prince sat at the grand piano. He talked to the audience and he took requests.
Stop it.
Yeah. Pointed at people, what do you want to hear?
I think that actually beats my story.
Go on, tell me your story.
I was at the Shaftesbury Avenue in some, I think it was the Shaftesbury Club, and it was a friend, a techie friend, who knew that he would be doing a small concert there.
Oh.
So I was taken into his private little room that was in the club, and I was sat down next to him.
Oh, my.
I have no idea what I spoke to or what I said. I was 20-something.
Oh, my God.
I then followed him out, and we danced on the dance floor.
Oh, my God, that beats my story. That is wicked.
But you know when you think, was that real? Did that really happen? Me dancing with... And then the whole dance floor just erupted into, you know, gyrating craziness. It was fantastic. Wow. That is something I'll never forget.
Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing. That's a cool story.
Okay, final... What would be your dream job?
I not long ago did one of my dream jobs. The film that I did in Rome, it's not a big movie, it's an independent film. It's set in the near future and it's a thriller and it's the kind of script that I would watch. That's the kind of, when I read the script, I thought this is the kind of thing I'd go and watch in the cinema. And it's about being able to say goodbye to your loved one if you didn't get a chance to say goodbye to them.
Oh.
Before they passed away. And it's taking their memories and implanting them in a host body. The title of the film is Another End, and I play a character called Dr. Doyle, who is a scientist and a doctor and the man who has created this procedure. And I run a very exclusive private clinic where this procedure takes place. And the brilliant Mexican actor, Gael Garcia Bernal, he plays a character who comes to see me at my clinic to talk about what's going on there. And also there's a fantastic actress called Berenice Bejo. And I play her character's boss, and all three of us have a secret, and we're trying to hold on to our secret and keep it locked as the film goes on. Gael and Berenice are both Academy Award nominees, you know, but more than that, they're really collaborative actors, and they're very warm people, and so working with them on our meaty scenes was great fun, actually. And together with the Italian director Piero Messina, we had the work felt good, and we had a great time doing it. Yeah.
Oh, wow! This sounds like a heavenly job.
It was lovely. It was really lovely. It was a really nice job for that. For the work, was lovely. You know, and it was nice atmosphere on the set, and it was doing proper work. A little bit of improvisation. If you wanted to do it, the director would say, we're going to go another one, pal. Say what you want to say. Just say whatever you feel like saying. You know, obviously keep it on story, keep it on track, but let's be loose. Let's play with this. And I was like, yeah, man, come on, let's have a bit of this.
Wonderful.
So that was a really nice thing to work on. And I think that's being released late this year or beginning of next year. So that was kind of a dream job. Just working with nice people. I'm older now, you know, I don't have this whole thing of these things need to be in place for a dream job. It really is just about working with nice people on a nice project.
Will you tweet that when that comes out so I can find out when it's on?
Yes.
That sounds a perfect piece of art.
I saw a bit of publicity about it the other day, and the publicity said exactly what I've just said. So that's, I'm not giving anything away, but there is so much more to it than I just said. And with actors like Gael and Berenice Bejo, she played Pepe Miller in The Artist. Do you remember the black and white film, The Artist, about talkies?
Yes,
and when
yes.
sound first comes in, she plays Pepe Miller, the dancer. She's brilliant and lovely and open and warm and nice, you know, and Gael was lovely as well. So So that was nice. And the director was great. And the writing was lovely. So that's all you want, really. And you just want to work with good people on a good script. That's all that I want to do. If I get that, that's a dream job.
Pal, the Bill fans will be absolutely thrilled that you've done this. So I just really, we're really grateful for your time.
You're welcome. It was lovely to connect with you again, Matt. And Oliver, it was a real pleasure to make your acquaintance, Matt. You're a gentleman and it's noticeable. So thank you.
Oh, and so are you, pal. It's really lovely to connect with you again. And I really hope there's a chance that we can maybe have a glass of red wine somewhere along the line.
That would be lovely. And wouldn't it be great if we could work together again?
I'd love that. Really
would. That would be wicked.
Oh, lots of love, pal.
Lots of love to you, Nat. Nice to talk to you again.
You too. Pal, thank you so much for being such a fantastic guest. And remember, if you're ever in Brighton, we offer a great view to go with your instant coffee. Join us again next month for a brand new set of interviews with another Sun Hill legend. Until then, take good care of yourselves and thank you for all your support of the Build podcast, you lovely people. Bye for now.